I like to take this opportunity to personally thank each and every one of you for your participation here today. I keep hearing from so many of you how excited you are to be here with your colleagues, because you're such admirers of so many of your colleagues, and they're saying the same thing about you. It's interesting for me to be that proverbial fly on the wall and hear from each of you about how much you enjoy getting to connect with your counterparts in this field. And I hope that from this conference we can continue that kind of connecting as we move forward to try to implement the bold strategy laid out in this 10-year plan. I'd like to, at this time, introduce a very special friend of mine and my family's. Just last week, and before I do, I might add, I want to introduce two family members, because that's how it relates to all of this. And that is my cousin Stephen Smith, who's here. Stephen, could you stand up? And that's my brother, Teddy. Teddy in the back, my brother Ted. And I have my fiance, who's also here, Amy. Where's Amy? I know she's trying to help me out every which way, so she's probably in the back trying to figure something out. Okay, there's Amy. Amy. So, it's all personal, as you've heard everybody talk about today. Every family member has a story of their own. And that's why, for all of those advocates in the field, you all are our first responders. You're the most important people in our lives. On the one-year anniversary of my dad's passing, I called Dr. Friedman down at Duke. And I said I knew he was probably getting asked about my dad on the anniversary of his passing and so forth and so on. I said I wanted to be one of those calls that he got during the day to tell him how grateful I am for his expertise and his skill in the field of neuroscience. Because in a real way, if it weren't for him, instead of it being the one-year anniversary of my dad's passing, it would have probably been the second-year anniversary. And in doing the work that he did, he gave me the most important year in the life that I had with my father that I ever could appreciate. And there's no way of quantifying how much of what he did meant the world to me in my life. At the end of the day, remember, all of you, you may be in academia, you may be in industry, you may be in basic science and research, but what you're doing is the most personal thing any family can ask for, and that's to help them take care of the people that they love in their lives. Ed Markey, a friend of mine in Congress, is somebody who brings the story of everybody when he brings a story about an issue, because he helps make sure people understand that in its essence form, politics is personal. And there's nothing more personal than taking care of the health and well-being of the people we love. Ed is the founder of the Alzheimer's Caucus in the United States Congress. I could be up here all day telling you about all the changes that he's made in law to help integrate and pay for and care for the people's care that we love so much, because at the end of the day, he was all doing it for one purpose, because he appreciated as a family member what these law changes meant to being a son who took care of his mother. Whatever we come out of with this conference, I hope we come out with an idea of the things that we need to do in order to better take care of the people we love. And I can tell you one thing. When I hand that agenda to people like Ed Markey, he's going to be able to take that agenda and breathe life into it on the floor of the United States House of Representatives. For that reason, he was just awarded the first annual Edward M. Kennedy Award for Advocacy. And my dad was known as the Lion of the Senate. Ed Markey is the Lion of the House. Please welcome Congressman Ed Markey.
Thank you, Patrick, so much. And thank you for everything that you have done to focus the country, the Congress, on the issue of the brain. Because of you, we now have mental health parity. Because of you, Patrick. Because of your advocacy, by going member to member to member in partnership with your great father, the greatest senator who ever lived, the healthcare senator for the 200 years of the history of the United States of America. And you are a you're a healthcare hero, Patrick, and I think that we're seeing the start of something very big here today. And I think that it is what has been needed, and your dedication, your passion, along with Mr. Staglin, and along with Provost Hyman here, have helped to bring together something that I think is ultimately going to be quite magical. I'm a politician. I'm an Irish Catholic politician from Boston. But I married the dream. I married a Jewish doctor, okay? So I know where Irish Catholic politicians are in the total hierarchy of things. And what Patrick has done is helped to bring together all of you here, who we are going to depend upon to put together the plan that will make it possible for us to make it possible for children to have to look to the history books to ever find that there was such a thing as diseases of the brain, which we could not cure. And that won't be a congressman. That won't be politicians. Congressional expert is an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp or Salt Lake City nightlife. I mean, we are not experts compared to real experts. That's what you do. And Patrick and Ted Kennedy Jr., his great brother, who is here, who has dedicated himself to those same sets of issues, Stephen Smith, but all of you in the Kennedy family. I mean, you are the Mount Rushmore of political leaders who have dedicated your lives to ensuring that we have the leadership which we need. This is my 35th year in Congress, and it's an honor to be amongst all of you who are here. My mother used to say, when she was particularly disappointed in me, when I was a boy, she would say that she was going to donate my brain to Harvard Medical School as a completely unused human organ. And having all of you here looking at my head does make me, she's probably proud that there are so many of you here today looking at it, because it does need a lot of attention. So when my mother was diagnosed in 1985 with Alzheimer's, the conclusion which our family had reached reluctantly, only with the top doctor at Mass General, was that she had it. But even in asking my mother, the physician, to count backwards from 100 to 99 to 98 to 97, et cetera, where she lost track and she was the valedictorian of her high school class, I interjected and I said, "Ma, omne Gallia et divise in tres partes," and she said, "All Gaul is divided in three parts." And with that, the doctor just said, "Let's go outside for a couple of seconds so we can just talk about what your mother knows and doesn't know, and where she is in the totality of her mental functioning right now." And we were in denial. My father was a milkman. My mother was the valedictorian. So we made a decision, not we, my father made a decision as a milkman at the Hood Milk Company, that we were going to keep her in the living room. We didn't know a lot about this disease, But because my grandmother had died when my mother was a junior in high school and about to become valedictorian, she had to give up her dreams of going to college and raise the three younger girls. That was the social safety net before Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Huh? That's the way it was in 1926 in the United States of America. And so by the time she got married, 20 years later, the only guy around was the milkman. So she married a milkman, my mother, the valedictorian, who did calculus at the kitchen table for fun, even though she never had it, who could still remember all the Latin and all the French and everything else. And so my father would say, when I would say to him in Malden, in the living room, and I was living with him because my wife and I live in Washington, and so I would commute up here to Boston, and I would live there with my father and mother with Alzheimer's. I would say to my father as the years went by, maybe we should put Ma in a nursing home. And my father would say, Eddie, it was an honor that your mother married me. I was a milkman. No one is ever putting your mother in a nursing home. And so at age 80, 82, 84, 86, 88, 90, my father, and the right arm of a milkman carrying six milk bottles is the biggest arm a human being can have. His arm was the size of my legs. And so every night, 10, 12 times a night, no matter what the problem was, he'd turn her over, clean her off again, put her back to sleep. Huh? So all of these families are heroes, 5 million people with Alzheimer's today. Huh? But heroes need help, and they need hope, huh? That help is on the way. And unfortunately, most families do not have the right arm of a milkman to help them. And demographically, more often it's the woman trying to take care of the man. That's the nature of the disease. And it's very, very difficult and debilitating. So for me, it was hard to deal with living there with them. My father helping my mother, me helping my father. Huh? That's the way it had to be if we were going to successfully pull off this trick of having her make it all the way to 90 in the living room. So after she passed away, I decided that what I would do is to create an Alzheimer's caucus, Alzheimer's task force. We now have 200 members in the House and 40 members in the Senate. And as I went member to member, I would find that it actually knew no political boundaries. It divided evenly between Democrats and Republicans. And so the challenge, of course, is to raise it as an issue that would receive the attention that AIDS and cancer and the other issues had received in preceding years because of the incredibly great advocacy for more research in those areas. That's the challenge that we have in this area. It has never had that same level of advocacy. So we have a healthcare hurricane on the horizon. Caregivers right now provide the equivalent of about $144 billion worth of free care to people at home. That's Alzheimer's right now as a profile. Huh? Because every person with the disease has some other person in the family with it. That's 5 million with it, 5 million family members at some point. We are going to, by 2050, ramp up to perhaps 15 million baby boomers with it. That's 15 million baby boomers. 15 million people in the family, that's 30 million people with the primary reality in their life being Alzheimer's. Huh? That's a huge reality arriving almost as a demographic certainty if we do not make breakthroughs in this area. For people over 85, the fastest growing part of the population, one half of those people now have Alzheimer's. So this is an incredible moment for us. And if you just look at the 2010 federal budget, $93 billion went to care for Alzheimer's out of the Medicare budget, and $37 billion out of the Medicaid budget. So about $130 billion in 2010 went to Alzheimer's. The problem is that the Alzheimer's research budget only spends one penny for every $3.50 that is spent to care for Alzheimer's. So that's an imbalance that at the end of the day, we have to do something to rectify. And here's the problem. As these people advocate that we cut Medicare and Medicaid down in Washington, the Tea Party, they are simultaneously advocating that we cut the research at NIH. God is not so good that you can cut the funding to take care of the treatment for a disease and cut the funding to find the cure for the disease. Huh? That is a recipe for a financial and family disaster for year after year in our country. And by the way, by the time all of the baby boomers have retired, in constant dollars, constant 2011 dollars, it will cost $800 billion to deal with 15 million baby boomers with Alzheimer's. $800 billion. In constant dollars, today's defense budget for the country is $600 billion. Alzheimer's alone as a disease will be bigger in terms of the Medicare and Medicaid cost to our country, unless we construct a plan, unless we construct a pathway to be able to deal with these issues. So what I did, and it was kind of funny as I started on this little journey that I had in 1999, it turned out that what we would do with my mother is we would actually, to take her down to Revere Beach, which was her favorite place, so she could actually look out at the beach while we could get a Kelly's roast beef and read the Boston Globe, but she couldn't open the door from the inside because it was taped shut. That was illegal in 1999 under a law that said that somebody had to be homebound in order to get someone come in for 1 hour a day of visiting nurse. And it took me 3 years to get that changed. If you wanted to take your mother just to Mass and let her sit in the back aisle. Now, for my father, that was the only hour out of the house, if we could get her out of the house, huh? So and what I was told is that people would pretend that they had Alzheimer's in order to have someone come in and help them out for an hour a day. And I said, no one's going to pretend that they have Alzheimer's. But that was 3 years. And that was 1999, 2000, to get that law changed. What we've done over the years, on a bipartisan basis, with Chris Smith of New Jersey as my co-chair, is we've worked with the Alzheimer's Foundation, and there are people out here from the Alzheimer's Foundation that I've seen in the course of the day, to ensure that we begin to raise the profile of this issue. In the healthcare bill, which just passed, there is a provision called Independence at Home, which is going to create a 3-year pilot program, which begins the end of this year, which is going to encourage doctors, nurse practitioners, and others to all create strategies to keep people at home, partnering with the families, and saving the whole system money by keeping people out of the nursing home. How much money did my father save the system? Hundreds of thousands of dollars by keeping my mother out of the nursing home. So this is a strategy which is now the law, which will be put together as a pilot program in order to create new ways in which we think of those issues. Ted Kennedy was able to pass the CLASS Act. We took a big step forward with that bill, which will help Americans remain independent for as long as possible. A legacy of Senator Kennedy, that will help in revolutionizing care in a new insurance program that you can buy into while you are working. And if you become disabled, you can get a cash benefit to have someone come by and help you to get dressed, bathe, or prepare food in the morning. And then, in December, we were able to pass something called the National Alzheimer's Project Act. This was a huge breakthrough legislatively. The cost for Alzheimer's disease is already unsustainable. It is breaking families, straining the federal budget, and only getting worse as baby boomers age. This one disease is an enormous a challenge to all of us. So the NAPA, the National Alzheimer's Project Act, across disciplines, calls for the construction of a plan to fight Alzheimer's. And it's going to enlist people from all disciplines. And we hope that many of you volunteer for this project so that there is an interdisciplinary approach to thinking about that plan, that pathway, that advisory council will put together to deal with Alzheimer's. The experts will evaluate the health, care, and treatment of Americans with Alzheimer's across all federal agencies, coordinate the work between these agencies, accelerate the development of treatments, and ensure ethnic and racial populations at higher risk for Alzheimer's receive the attention that they deserve. That bill is now the law. The president just signed it into law. It was one of the last things he did in the last Congress. And finally, the HOPE Act. In the effort to take the next step, I introduced the HOPE Act, HOPE for Alzheimer's Act, in both the House and the Senate, with bipartisan support. The HOPE Act will incentivize doctors to perform comprehensive Alzheimer's assessments. Right now, only 19% of individuals with dementia over 65 have a diagnosis documented in their medical record. African Americans and Hispanic populations at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease are even less likely to have been diagnosed. Our bill encourages doctors to use a gold standard for diagnosing the disease, including a formal diagnosis if a patient shows signs of dementia and a follow-up conversation with the patient and the caregiver. This conversation between caregivers and doctors is significant. Unlike a patient receiving a breast cancer or a heart disease diagnosis, an Alzheimer's patient needs their beloved ones to help them prepare for the disease. It will be the caregiver, after all, that will help them remember their diabetes medication, for example, or avoid complications of hospitalizations. This breakthrough act will help us to move forward, to ensure that we have a plan for the future. So, at the end of the day, however, I believe that too much of this is in different silos and that we really do need to put together a comprehensive plan that brings it all together across all agencies, across all studies that are going on, so that everyone who is thinking about the brain, working on the brain, is looking for clues that can be helpful in other aspects of research which is going on with the brain. It is too complex for any one subgroup to have to work on. And the more that we can construct that kind of a strategy for the breakthrough, which is what the Alzheimer's Breakthrough Act is focused upon, then I think the more successful that we can be. Patrick has called this the moonshot moment, the mission to the mind, and I think that he's right. Because when you think back to Apollo 13, when those astronauts were up there and something went wrong, and they did not know how to come back. They had to figure out a way to jury rig, to find different component parts that had never been used before in order to construct a methodology to break through in a way that had never been anticipated in the past. And as they were putting it through, the message that they sent to the world was that failure was not an option. And when they did find all of those component parts and jury-rigged that spaceship and brought it back, all of us knew that the dedication of those astronauts and those in the space control down in Houston made it possible for us to do it. Well, for the brain, space control is right here. You are the control room for the brain, the people in this room. You're the ones that have to find the way that we take all these various pieces and put it together so that we can see the brain and all of its component parts, because here, failure is not an option. The consequences for our country